Hello and welcome to the Tech Bytes Audiocast. My name's Tim and I'm from the Oak Bytes Blogger Zine, and with me is Dr. Roy Shesterwitz from the Tech Writes website.
It's Friday night and I'm gonna get sauce. I fought the troll and the troll lost. I fought the troll and the troll lost. He tried to boss me and was outbossed. I fought the troll and the troll lost. I fought the troll and the troll lost. Underneath his creeper bridge, hoping goats will cross. Quoting Ashcroft.
Hello and welcome to what I think is episode 88 of the Tech Show. I'm back again, Tim, and I'm with Roy, who hopefully is on the other end right now.
Of course. Yes, it is episode 88, and it's only the second time we do a show this year. Because we're really getting back into it, and it's becoming quite difficult. Well, I think for both of us, for family reasons.
It is sort of working. I mean, we had a bit of a failure last week, which was completely my fault. I had intended to come on the weekend. It seems to be working reasonably. So, yes, without further ado, I think you've got the topics, Roy, and I've got whatever I've got. So, on you go.
Well, I wish I had a topics, but we never write them down, actually, and this is something we've done since day one in 2010. We have some ideas of things that might be worth covering. Usually it's just the latest news. So, speaking of latest news, about 2-3 hours ago, someone in the IRC channel posted a link saying that the Microsoft Xbox One will cease production. Now, based on what I've read, only read two articles because it's really like breaking news. The story would say, would have you convinced that they have done what's called channel stuffing, which means that they have stuffed every piece of shelf that would be, shall we say, tolerable of an Xbox One surveillance device. And right now there is no room to fill because nobody really takes them, you know, off the shelves. Basically, they're not selling well. Microsoft would tell us that they sold like whatever 5 million units, but no, they sold it to the stores. In other words, they stock them up in the stores, and there is no demand for them, which basically means nobody's buying them. So production has officially stopped. Who knows if it'll pick up at some stage? And it's great news for Sony. It's very embarrassing for Microsoft.
Yeah, it's. I mean, I've just been, while you were saying that short intro piece, I've just been looking up on the net to see what was said about it, and I found a few genuine sites, as I would call them, more trustworthy sites that
it's
reported the same news.
It's very kind of breaking news. I'm not sure if it's just a few hours old, or maybe it's something from this morning, to be honest.
I mean, over on Gamer Evolution, they seem to echo what you just said. It may be a case that they're going to be slowing production rather than stopping it, but it's they're citing excess supply as the reason. However, with this being Microsoft, the skeptic in me can't help but thinking, is this another one of their ploys? We often see them claiming running out of stock for products. I think Windows Phone was claimed to have run out of stock and there's only a few available.
I don't think that would serve them well. Another piece of news is about the so-called Surface. Which I found to be funny. We never covered this before because we didn't really do many shows when Microsoft was creating those lockdown devices they called Surface. Now, it's not as big, what's known as the big-ass table, the old Surface that they had. It's this basically a subsidized on the face of it device running this, what I call VState, horrible operating system that I happen to have used in the airport. Complete rubbish. You know, very difficult to use for very basic things, not at all usable. And I think the, I can't remember his name now, the guy who was behind basically got fired like last year. Complete disaster. And this is worse than Vista, the original Vista, not Vista. And the story in the Register, which was written by Gavin Clark, he's a Microsoft booster for many years now, basically said that the more they sell, the more they lose. And I think the business model there is just to try to get you hooked onto Microsoft services, getting your data, whatever. We know that the CIA and NSA actually subsidized Microsoft for Snoops, and we know this because we have leaks to show it. So maybe that's the business model. Now, they also didn't manage to sell many of those things last year, and they actually lose money on that. So putting all those things together, you see the hardware side of Microsoft, or Microsoft trying to reinvent itself as hard soft, is not really working too well. And that's good, of course, because this is what they were gambling on as the next thing after the Windows monopoly or the common carrier being Windows.
It beggars belief a little bit because, I mean, there's no arguing, certainly in the UK, the Xbox, the original Xbox. And originally when you said this story about Xbox One, I was thinking maybe somebody was getting confused and posting a rumor about the original Xbox and just saying Xbox One, meaning that the latest one would be an Xbox Two type thing. But the problem that Microsoft got with the Xbox One, as I see it, and really this should have been glaringly obvious to them, is that the main competition that they had was cheaper, and it also was higher, well, it is higher spec than their Xbox One console, which doesn't bode well. Now, with consoles, I've noticed a lot of people, and this was the same with a lot of my friends and people I know, they have a console for a long time, for example, the Xbox, and they get fed up of the console, they get fed up of the user interface, and they want to have a look and see what other machines have to offer. And of course, the Sony PlayStation 3 saw a massive increase in sales right towards the end, when really it shouldn't have been gaining sales at all, because the PS4 was coming out, the original Xbox was or 360 was entrenched in the marketplace, and just one step into a computer games outlet would show you by the shelf space dedicated to the titles, and the Xbox 360 was already sort of in a lot of people's homes. So really, to release a machine that's powered, well, underpowered compared to PS4. And overpriced compared to the PS4.
Self-limiting as well.
Yeah, and I mean, Nintendo made exactly the same error. I mean, you look at the Nintendo Wii U, that's barely more than what the Xbox 360 is now in terms of specification. Yet Nintendo expected people to pay out for this new console, in quotes, and all the only bonus it had was a fancy new controller. Well, that controller could have been made to work with the original Wii. They would have saved themselves a lot of money, a lot of development costs, and probably still made a massive profit. So I think that where the console market is going now anyway, you look at all the different variations of choice you have, and you've got the Wii U. Well, I think most people, that's a non-starter. I don't think there's going to be many people, maybe a couple of, you know, few units are sold to families with children who the kids have persuaded their parents that they want a Wii U because they want to play the new Mario game. But I think for the majority of games, and for the majority of people, it's between Xbox One and PS4. And I think the other problem that they have now is that people aren't quite ready to upgrade yet either. I mean, PS3 still has a massive following. The PS4s have sold very well. But if you go into your local shop, you've got more space because there's more titles for the PS3, and people still, you know, buying and selling their PS3 titles. I don't think they're quite ready to make the leap yet. So it's important that if you've got a market like that, and I assume it was the same for the Xbox 360 users, where they're not quite ready to make the leap, it's important that when they do make the leap, that leap is substantially bigger. So the PS3 went to PS4, and specs-wise, you look at a massive jump in terms of specifications. Xbox 360, not so much. And when it's more expensive than its competitor, and obviously I've already said better specs, really there's not much of an appeal for people to buy it. So it doesn't surprise me that this has all ended a little bit sour.
Yeah, well, we're in the UK, so this is a fairly Xbox friendly country.
Mm-hmm.
Historically, and maybe presently as well. I happen to have seen a queue of people standing in a line at some store, and by the banners, I could say, oh, it must be the launch day or something of Xbox in the UK. Xbox One, I mean. And I haven't been following this very closely, because to tell you the truth, in recent years, maybe 2-3 years, I've not been following Microsoft so closely. But I think that PS4 is doubling Xbox One in terms of sales. This is a very different... And also, of course, Xbox 360 came out a year before PS3, Microsoft doesn't have this advantage, and it seems like Microsoft is basically just stuck in the channels right now.
Yeah, I mean, it may well swing around the other way if this news story is correct, and if the market's saturated with Xbox Ones that aren't being sold, maybe it'll hopefully encourage a price drop, which may be the thing that would cause people to buy them up.
And, I don't really see why people buy those things, to be honest. I mean, Steam locks is... No, sorry, they call them Steam machines now. The Steam machines are based on Debian, Goodness Watch Linux, and these are the... there are a bunch of them. Different brands make them. Different companies integrate different components, and it's approved by Steam to run Steam OS or whatever, which is based on Debian. And these things, if you wish, could probably function as a computer very much in the same way PS3 could have.
With your Steam boxes, the problem you're looking at there is it all comes down to titles. They, you know, for example, when the PS3 was released, I believe the launch title there was God of War, which was an amazing tech demo. I didn't see much of a game in that at all, personally. And it was more of a tech demo, but it managed to hook in a massive crowd of customers. And it's all about the games now. And it's exactly the same way as why Windows Phone hasn't appealed to the mainstream consumer, whereas Android did, is because all the developers are on Android and the software, the marketplace is larger, the software is more diverse, they've got so much more choice. It's the same in the console world. If people are going to plug something into their television in the front room, they want it having Grand Theft Auto or whatever it is they happen to, or God of War 3, I think.
I should mention, it's not only Steam that's completely transforming the... I should mention this. Last time when we were very consistent with doing the show, the state of games on Goodness Watch Linux wasn't that exciting. I mean, it was starting to pick up with Steam. Now, the several headlines about new game engines being ported to Linux and also the drivers are improving a great deal. So, if you look at, go to like Google News and put something like Linux, you'll see like more than half the headlines will be about some games. And that tells the story. Linux is one of the big boys when it comes to, like, you know, games. There is no discrimination against it among most of the big gaming franchises.
The issue you've got, though, and like I say, is in the mainstream consumer's mind, and you see this with Canonical a lot with their Ubuntu distro, they don't mention the word Linux. Now, whether that's intentional, I'm sure...
I don't think there is a stereotype so strong anymore.
No, I think there's any sort of stereotype. I don't think the mainstream consumer would know what Linux is. They've got no stereotype. You know, there's no bad press about it in terms of what they would conjure up in their mind.
I think they know. You'd be surprised. My mother knows what it is. And she's not a technically savvy person, but she heard the name before.
Yeah, but there's no adverse connotation to the word Linux in the mainstream consumer's mind, as far as I'm aware. I've certainly not come across it. Usually the response to the word Linux is, what's that? But certainly nothing negative about it. But I think the problem is market knowledge. Now, people know about PlayStation, they know about Microsoft, they know about Xbox, they know about the Wii U. And these things are the things that they'll spend their money on, because when you're parting with £300-400 for a dedicated console, you want something that's going to have a bit of staying power, and you have to be very unfortunate to buy into a console that's got a big name and end up losing out because of the console flops, like Sega Saturn, I believe, was one.
Well, Linux doesn't need to target... why do people know Xbox and stuff? One thing, it's at the store, and it says on it Xbox or PlayStation. The other reason is they put it on TV, and they spend a lot of money. People who buy those consoles, they get a single-purpose machine with high cost. And in the case of Xbox One, if you wish, I can go again talking about surveillances with the previous show. But this is basically a surveillance device, and we also know that the GCHQ in the UK was thinking about using the Kinect for surveillance on people. Xbox Live is, as we know, not only being eavesdrops Eve's dropped on, but also people who are doing in-game chat are under surveillance by moles, essentially, inside the games. And this is leaks from, like, I don't know, November, maybe October last year. So this is not, like, a very appealing place to be if you wish to play games. You're under surveillance. You're only renting a device. It's all basically a very single-purpose device that would refuse to do anything except playing the games, which are themselves encrypted, so that, you know, I can only enable them for play if you've purchased the license, which of course can expire, and they can delete things remotely. So, you know, here you have a situation where people are buying very unattractive devices because they go by names and brands and perceptions that, oh, if I have a PlayStation, all my friends are going to want to come over to my house and play the game. Whereas with Linux, it's targeting a technical crowd, so the Linux Foundation, which is a branding company run by a branding person, Jim Zemlin. He's a branding guy, if you look at his career. And the other people are PR people. Their goal is to try to promote Linux to developers and to big corporations that make server hardware and printing and, you know, all that sort of stuff. So it's a very different audience. So to say the word Linux, it should mean something to a developer, but not to, like, a person going into a store, because nothing's going to say Linux or have a Tux, you know, mascot on it.
Well, sticking on the subject of gaming, very briefly, I wouldn't mind just making a quick mention of a piece of software, open source software called Stellar. It's a Atari 2600 emulator, and I've recently given it a little bit of treatment over on my little site. So if I may, I will go into a little bit more detail in that. Stellar 3.9.3 came out roughly the end of January, and basically it does what it says in the tin. It's an Atari 2600 emulator. Now, for those of you listening that aren't as old as myself, it was a console from around the early 80s, plugged into your television, and it produced some pretty basic games. I think it's... cartridges had a 1K capacity, or certainly very, very small capacity. And it had about a few hundred titles that came out for the machine over its life. And it was horrendously popular because at the time, for most people, it was the first ever console or gaming device that they had in their home. So things like Bat and Ball and a sort of Arkanoid clone and Frogger and stuff was quite an amazing thing. So Stellar seeks to emulate all of that on your Linux machine. Obviously, it has a Linux binary. You can probably find it in most of the repos of most distributions, although probably not the latest version, but certainly one close. And this package has been mature for quite a while now. The bugs that have been ironed out, really, now it's just fine-tuning. It's been complete and very solid for many, many years. I remember Stellar appeared in the Puppy Arcade distribution I reviewed many years ago, and even then it was mature and fully working. So great little package, gives you access to the whole catalogue of Atari 2600 games, which funnily enough I think equates to about 4 megabytes, or certainly no more than 5 in size, which gives you an example of how compact the games were in those days and how small they were. Great bit of fun for all of about 5 or 10 minutes, probably a minute a game, because once you see the restrictions that the machine had in terms of graphics and sounds, I think after the novelty factor's worn off, you'll tire of them very quickly. So I wrote a little piece on that over on my OpenBytes blog. I'm sure there'll be a link in the show notes. And also got a lot of flack for making a few flippant remarks about a community which exists, apparently, of 2600 enthusiasts that still play these games. But if you want to have a look, it's a bit light-hearted, a bit of fun. It's over on OpenBytes. I'll stick the link in the show notes. And it's a very good little package, if only for about half an hour of your life. I would start to worry about anybody who spent a significant amount of time playing these games, because they are very basic. And when you get titles like Room of Doom, I think you can imagine how complex these things are. But so that was that. Just looking over some of the other things I covered. If I may, Roy, just if I can throw a few more things in. There's a great little Linux title customizable card game, and it's called Forgotten Myths. And did we mention this one last time, Roy?
I don't think we did. We concentrated on the surveillance.
Good. Yeah, it's called Forgotten Myths. It's a customizable card game for Linux. It also works on Android, and it's a really great little game, a lot like Magic the Gathering, if anybody played that. It's not open source. It is a proprietary title. However, the reason I mention it is because the developers have developed for every platform, but they've also included Linux, which is a very nice touch. That obviously shows us quite a few players out there who have Linux desktop who do want to get involved. You can check that out on my site as well. That's been linked to. It's quite complicated. It's certainly not a Candy Crush type game, so it's going to take a bit of your time to learn the rules, but it's horrendously good fun, and you can play it online against other people, and it's free. So check that one out. And I'll throw it back over to you for the next topic.
Yeah. Have you had any experience with Good Old Games, GOG?
No.
Heard of it. So this apparently was ported to, I think it was announced that it would be ported imminently to Linux. Now, I'm not sure how this relates to some of the other frameworks for game distribution and development, but basically what this means, this announcement, literally hundreds, if not thousands of games, not very old games, but old games, will be available for a person who wishes to run them on a GNU/Linux system or a Steam machine or whatever it is that's based on a platform that's free software, possibly with free hardware as well. So this is another bit of very major news. It's about a month old now. And I have to say that the only kind of downside to all this is every free open source game that I know of really struggles to get media attention right now, even within the GNU Linux community of blogs, sites, whatever. And even if they do exist and they have a new release, nobody would really want to bother with them because they get all very excited about the latest and greatest games. Now, it's not, actually, the FSF has made an announcement about news from Valve. I think it was a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, I think it was. 2 years ago, the announcement came. Ever since then, we've had literally hundreds of games added. This past year, the growth, I think, has been something like 900%. In the number of games. It's really quite an amazing growth, and you can really see there is commitment to it. However, a lot of the games that will be, accepted and embraced openly do not give you access to the source code. The drivers themselves, it's a bit of a mixed bag because you know the graphics drivers will be absolutely essential to running those polygon drawing games, and if the drivers themselves remain proprietary, it means that yes, you might have Linux underneath and you might have GNU and you might have your desktop, but everything that will deal with the game, including the rendering of the stuff on the screen, will be handled by completely proprietary code, just blobs that you have no access to. And it's kind of okay, depends what your goal is. But at the same time, I wouldn't be vocal about it. So I kind of have a category of the games, and I put all the, yeah.
For me, I've always put games into a separate category. There is no argument that open source software, as far as utility is concerned, and then the desktop, it's been, well, offers incredible advantages to everybody, that's both users and developers, and there's no question that. I think one of the problems that open source gaming has is that the competition. If you look at the proprietary gaming market, for example, is absolutely saturated. I mean, it's now even at a stage where even the consoles are getting in on the old retro gaming. So not only do you have all the new console releases and all the new sort of latest titles, you've also got them producing emulators or emulation for all the older titles as well. So the market's absolutely saturated. So before you even get off the starting line, you've got to produce something which is pretty big to get people's attention. And these days, you know, when you're looking at what the average gamer can play, I mean, there's so many proprietary titles, or the freemium ones, where they support in-app purchases, which hook a lot of people in into the games without having to pay anything initially. And then when they want to continue on or get that bit further, that bit quicker, they have to end up forking out money. Now, with all that going on, regardless of what's being produced in the open source world, it's very difficult to compete. It would have to be incredibly special to be noticed. I mean, there's a couple of titles which stand out for me, which I've been following for a long time. But again, even though they've stood out to me and I've been very interested and I've played them, they're still far from being complete, which is another problem in the open source world. We don't, unlike a proprietary game where it gets sent to the user as a complete package and ready to go, and sure, it might have a few bugs or errors that need a ironing out, but it's a ready-to-go package. With open source gaming, it's very rare. I certainly haven't come across...
I would say the opposite. Proprietary package would run only the target platforms.
Oh, yeah,
and it would run at a certain time. Whereas the open source one, even if it's not officially ported to a platform, you could find somebody who ran the source code or compiled the source code for another platform. So the source code actually gives you more versatility and the ability to run on more places. Whereas the proprietary game might work very well, but only because they target a specific architecture, specific product, specific brand,
and this is a problem, you see, isn't it? Because the average gamer, or the person who plays games, has no interest in the majority of the source code or programming or computing. They play games.
Sure. Okay, so if a game comes out PlayStation 3,
yep,
and you don't have a PlayStation 3, I think you'll be pretty upset.
That's the whole point.
To get a PlayStation 3.
Yeah.
So that's not a very good experience. If it was free software, maybe it would be available or possible.
There's no doubt it would be better, but the fact is it would never. It doesn't happen like that. And like I say, the issue with the open source gaming is you buy your Grand Theft Auto, your Call of Duty, you buy it, you put it in, it's a complete game, it's ready to roll. Like I say, they may add a few little bits and pieces a bit later on or whatever, but it's ready to go. And the problem with open source gaming is it's an onward stage of development. The game I mentioned, which is very close to my heart, is a game called Pioneer, which is actually the open source version of Elite 2 Frontier, which was a fantastic game on the PC and Amiga that I played on. It's basically the follow-up to Elite. Absolutely fantastic, but that's still in development. That's been running for 4 years, or even more probably. Now, with that type of... I'm dedicated to following that because I was a fan of the game. However, for the average gamer who wants to go out and play Grand Theft Auto and wants to be shooting their whatever straight away, they're not going to stick around for 4 years. And they've got these consoles right now. And this is why open source gaming in particular has such a problem, because it has to get through the adverts for Grand Theft Auto.
I'm not sure. So we have two sources of confusion here. I mean, the one thing is, being free doesn't mean you couldn't be commercial.
Wait.
More important point here is different. Gaming is a very competitive market. If you hit a jackpot, you can make a lot of money, in the same way that the Harry Potter series of books was exceptionally profitable. And a lot of people, they hope to hit a jackpot. Same happens with singers. You know, if you're like Britney Spears or Lady Gaga or whatever, you can make a reasonable living, especially if you're working for the labels. But they can actually live on that. But for the vast majority of singers and bands, they will never be able to even pay, you know, for the rent using their music. Now, with games, all the games, as you saw with the Wii or with the Samsung Galaxy series, there's a lot of players, for instance, mobile phone manufacturers, designers, and they all hope to be one of those people who will give a big return to the investors by creating the next Galaxy series and making billions upon billions. But with games too, you have very few games that can succeed. Now, the problem that of competition is very, very, very great, also for proprietary games. So maybe you've got 1,000 proprietary games and a few dozens of free software games, free games, whatever you want to call them. But among those 1,000 proprietary games, it's possible that only like 10 of them will be exceptionally successful, and 900 of them will be like seriously in losses and not satisfying their shareholders, you know, hopes and stuff. So just the fact that something is free does not in itself mean that it will fail.
No.
Currently, we don't have any exceptionally successful thing that I can, exceptionally successful game that I can think of, which is also free software. However, we do have this in web servers, we have this in browsers, we have this in kernels, we have this in many things. In games, with things like Angry Birds being out there and, I don't know, Cut the Rope, none of them is really free software, even in mobile.
And that's exactly why I started my my little opinion there with in the utility world. And like I say, I try to put the gaming over to a separate group, because I've said for a long, long time that if we're talking about success, and I was trying to wrap my brain while you were talking as to a game which you could mention, like Sonic the Hedgehog, but a game from an open source game which everybody recognises the name of, and I can't specifically think of one, and that's not me trying to be facetious, I can't think of one at the moment. But I think games, by their sheer nature, and it's a very transient market as well, because you've got to remember, people get into a series of games like Mario or Sonic or whatever, and these are very basic examples, but they'll get into them and they'll go out of favour, and then a new franchise will come along. Maybe it'll be Call of Duty, maybe it'll be Grand Theft Auto, maybe it'll be whatever, but they're very fickle, and it's a very transient market. And even with the consoles themselves, there's no loyalty, because when the next console comes along that offers something better, they'll swap brands in a second. There's very few people who will stay loyal to one particular console, not certainly in any great numbers. And I think this is why, certainly in respect of gaming, open source and proprietary, it has to be pushed over into a separate
group.
That
might change. Okay, so you've mentioned the
ecosystem behind it. I mean, the ecosystem behind the whole gaming thing, where you've got a console like a PlayStation, or it doesn't support the idea of open source software.
Well, I'll tell you why I think that's a misguided explanation of it, in my opinion. You've mentioned things like Sonic the Hedgehog and Mario Brothers series, whatever it is, with the racing or jumping and taking mushrooms, whatever. This goes back to a period which was not only the infancy of free software in the modern stage. Of course, there was free software before. Originally, computers were free software. People were sharing everything. However, it also goes before the age of the World Wide Web. So for a company that makes machines that are not programmable per se, they have not magnetic tape, and they have just circuits wrapped inside of some plastic, the notion of sharing your source code would be completely dubious and nebulous. Like, there is no World Wide Web, there is no website for a company like Sony, so how do you expect them to publish the source code for Sonic the Hedgehog? That was Mega Drive. Was it the Sony one?
Yeah, I was just giving it. I just threw a mainstream example. I'm just trying to think of a Sony title, that sort of note. Sony,
Japanese one, whatever. Yeah. But the fact is, those games couldn't really have the source code distributed, because there is, I mean, what are they supposed to do? The form of media back then was like, you know, floppy disks and stuff. Are they supposed to give you like a floppy disk with a source code when you buy the cassette or something? It makes no sense. There is no website yet. There's no such thing. So from there we move onwards to like the 90s and whatever, and free software was not very big back then. Netscape was proprietary. Windows was proprietary, OS 2 was proprietary, almost everything was proprietary. That was the golden era of proprietarization of software. After back in the 80s, people in like computer labs, such as in MIT, I know of, we're starting to kind of turn products into so-called solutions, and there would be no access to, you know, how these things are real. That changes now. IBM has just announced that they call open power, which is a way of just open washing the, you know, power infrastructures and architecture. But they start to now market things as this is the open solution. This is supporting lots of different operating systems. You can look inside, you can download schematics maybe. And that's starting to catch on. So I think with games, it's possible some games will try to distinguish themselves by saying, like, hey, let's collaborate on this development, you know, create new characters and add them to your game, and maybe we'll put it up to our repository.
I mean, it will be the next version. And it makes perfect sense what you've just said, but how I saw the gaming market develop was slightly different. I mean, I was lucky enough to be on Micronet. This was way before the World Wide Web. It was a Spectrum 48K service where, with I believe a 300 board or 900 board modem, you would connect via dial-up to a thing that resembled something that you see on Teletext or CFAX, if anybody remembers the old Teletext service on the British TV. That had the facility there. You could actually buy games and you could actually download them. And they had a selection of public domain software for what I say public domain, that's probably the best description of what it was, shareware titles then. I think the reason why proprietary software stayed in the mainstream was because that's what made the money, because there was no reason for people to give the source code for their latest game because they were selling it to a mainstream.
I'll tell you why they have no regions. Okay, let's say you got your BBS server. Now, showing you the source code without you being able to exercise the right to change it and to redistribute is kind of futile. You can see how it works, the code, but it probably won't be that interested. Especially won't be interested unless you can contribute and to share the changes, either returning it to the original developer or making your own version. Now, even if you have access to the source code on a BBS server somewhere, how are you going to distribute this to people and do so legally? Now, you might be able to say this is, you know, a better version of it, I removed some of the flaws and the bugs, but how are you going to advertise that? You have no website, there is no such thing as a website, and people are not going to come and download your version, so the incentive to really create your own versions of things is quite low. And even back then, you know, people deal with very small amounts of memory and storage space, so compiling your own program or especially something like a game is just a bit unrealistic unless you're like in a research lab somewhere. So it couldn't reflect upon those times and say, well, back then there was no free software, because we kind of know the internet drove what we now know as this revolution that makes the best browsers, the best web servers, and a lot of the world's infrastructure, the so-called cloud, whatever you want to call it, is very much free software reliant. It's because there is the internet, because there is things like GitHub and people can collaborate on code and
pass it around. Again, I think without laboring the point, I think there is a definite line between utility and adapting utilities to your names. For example, BBS software. I was trying to remember what software I used when I ran a BBS on the Amiga, and it escapes me what I was using, but it's certainly a public domain BBS server. But I think there is a massive line there. And like I say, with our gaming industry, because fashion's coming in and out, I say fashion's probably a bad word for the game, but trends come in and out with games, and what might be a hit one week, certainly that genre of game isn't. I mean, we progressed from all sorts of variations of a genre over the years. So I think there's a line. I mean, I would like to see a time when, yes, you would get source code. I mean, I personally wouldn't. If I was going to play a game, I'd play a game. I've got no real interest in modifying it, changing it, or doing anything with it. But I would like to see a time when that's available. I just can't see it.
A lot of the games is a lot of the games these days are not starting by writing an engine from scratch, and you can classify different games, like, you know, put them on a scatter map and say this one is based on the following engine and this one is based on the following engine, and making like a bunch of islands, and they're all connected. A lot of the engines, by the way, are free software these days, or and components of them will be free software. So a lot of the games themselves, you could call them skins. It would be a funny way of saying it, but you kind of say, I'm going to get Unreal Engine with the skin, the alien skin or the army skin, and what it will involve is characters. So the engine will deal with different data sets. So the games then become a form of art, copyright. So there will be a bunch of artists sitting with Blender, if they want to use free software, and designing characters, and then there will be rules on how they behave. Usually the physics is done by some free open source software, or proprietary, if some prefer it. And we also interviewed in one of our shows some of the game developers, and I think they were using some kind of engine that, you know, would handle the physics, and I think it was free software. I can't remember right now when we interviewed them.
Greedy Car Thieves?
Yeah.
Which was based
Yeah, and it's a very nice game. It looks very nice, and there's a lot of reuse of code. Now, here's kind of a hypothetical proposition of sorts. Maybe one day some game company will decide, okay, we would like to start this open source crowdsourcing gaming thing. Send us images of yourself, or send us 3D sets that you created in your house of cars and people, and let's create a game together. And the funding will be easier to take care of, because people will sign away a kind of a waiver saying you can use it in any way you want for the game. And people will feel like part of the game. They will feel involved. Maybe lots of them will want to play it. To some degree, that's what we had with Second Life, if you can remember it still. I think it's kind of extinct now.
Wasn't that written with
some mono there?
Yeah, I was going to say, wasn't that a mono?
but let's not concentrate on that. It's written with various things, and Unity 3D uses mono as well. So quite a few games have some element of mono in them, but and Firefox wants to do some kind of a game in how should I put it? They want to market Firefox as a gaming platform in which you can render games and play games, and one of the first deals they did to achieve that was with Unity. Although they wouldn't say it very publicly, it was to do with Mono to some degree. And when I was first appointed as like the CEO, before the whole shitstorm started, I kind of said like the one thing we need to fix is them dealing with Unity, because shortly afterwards they dealt with another game engine within Firefox. So it's not, doesn't have to be just Unity 3D, which is using Mono. And you do see that there are several efforts to bring together things that are free software to kind of lower the barrier to entry as you wish to approach potential users of games, so they don't have to download the game, they can play it over the web, and also it will be easier to develop for, because you have the framework, you just have to provide some inputs. Back in like the 90s, there were several frameworks in which you could kind of create your own games, and it was a bit of a hip thing, at least back then. You can create your own quest, like, you know, King's Quest and Space Quest and Police.
That's Sierra Online, wasn't that?
Yeah, they had some frameworks by which you could put the characters and move them around and define rules by which basically they gave you like bits of what they were using themselves, I suppose, to create their games, and they let you create your own game. It's not been around for a while. I've not seen anything like this recently, but Well, in any case, I think that the point to make here is let's wait and see if the whole crowdsourcing mentality, which is very, very hot right now in the open source intelligence community, as you might call it, like Facebook, where people are basically doing peer surveillance and acting as informants on each other. Let's see if that mentality will be used positively to create fun games for people that they can participate in.
Well, just my final controversial thing on this subject before we move on, and obviously feel free if you want to shout back at me afterwards, but I'm going to say this about gaming, and like I say, I make a clear distinction here. My personal opinion says that gaming is in a separate box to everything else that we enjoy in the open source world, which undoubtedly has so many benefits being open source software, but the gaming is in a different box. And I'll give an example, and I always look back to a game from, I believe, mid-80s, I think that was when it was released, and it was called Elite, and it was a game written by Ian Bell and David Braben, and it was put on most platforms I can think of at some point in their history. This game was written in 32K, and it contained an accurate star map of the entire galaxy as part of the game, and it was sort of like the first type sandbox type game on the 8-bit computers. Very popular, very successful, and an amazing piece of programming work made by two geniuses who went on to write many other amazing pieces of software. Now, if I skip on a few years and we look at the demo scene on Amiga, and to a varying degree on Atari ST as well, both these environments, demo scene on the Amiga and the proprietary gaming scene on the 8-bit computers, they didn't share their code. There was no collaboration. And as a result, instead of having being held back, what you got was far more creativity, because, for example, in terms of the Amiga demo scene, you had demo crews which were making basically tech demos showing the advantages of the Amiga computer example of the Amiga demo scene, and they would break all the rules. They would do things which were completely unwritten in the tech manuals that apparently were impossible to produce, and they did that because they're in competition with other groups who also didn't share their source code and wouldn't say their secrets. And as a result, some of the boundaries that the Amiga had placed in it when it was first released and its tech manuals were publicly released were completely broken because of these people that sat in rooms trying to outdo their friends. The same in the proprietary world. I mean, had the Elite developers, he didn't have any other source code to cut, copy and paste from. He didn't have any World Wide Web to have debates about and throw code up and get opinions and have a look at other people's similar works. He had to sit in the bedroom or an office somewhere.
They could copy and paste. I mean,
well, okay. No, I was just
look at the way. Metaphor. Okay, look at the beginnings of Microsoft. I don't want to go into this, but there was a lot of copying by hiring people who had worked for previous companies or competitors.
Oh, that was a business
basically
plan.
Reproduce. Yeah. Yeah. So there was a lot of copying and pasting, and it was hidden by compiling the code. Mm. And it took a while to see all that. There were lawsuits as well. So that was happening, it just wasn't legalized in the same way that a lot of people do things or consume drugs that are not legal, but just because we are not catching them doesn't mean it's not happening.
I think in the case of things like Elite, and that was just one example, I mean, that was something that was so completely unique and so completely novel. Technically, or on paper, it should be impossible. You cannot have a fully functioning star map on a 32-bit computer, a 32K computer, on a 5.25-inch floppy disk. It just can't be done. It just on a pure numbers basis for the amount of data. But somehow, Ian Bell and David Braben have developed this piece of code which ran on the BBCB and then a few other computers after that, and it developed over time. And they didn't have the luxury.
Maybe this, even back in the 80s, we knew that there were, you know, at least back then 100, if you look at Cosmos, the number back then was 100 million suns. So even if you do the mathematics, even if they made a binary map where every, you know, just the existence of a star is mapped, there's far too few ones and zeros to just even account for the number.
But, the point I make, I mean, is just, I think there is a definite distinction. And if I may, I'll just add one final point, which is completely uncontroversial about my opinion in respect of gaming, which had a lot of people quite confused. It's been reported in the last, I believe, a few days, ET has been discovered in New Mexico. It's been dug up and discovered. Now, this had a lot of interest initially because it was very badly reported by some people on their Twitter feeds. And by all accounts, a lot of conspiracy folk and alien believers have been interested in this. Well, what it actually was back to the Atari 2600. Now, many years ago, when the Atari 600 was in its heyday in the 80s, they released a game called ET, and it was based on the film, and it was predicted to be horrendously popular. But unfortunately, the game was rushed. They had very little time to produce it, and when it hit the shelves, it was one of the worst titles, even in the Atari 2600s, that anybody had ever played, and they only ended up shifting about, I believe, about 500,000 units, which was appalling, because they produced millions expecting a smash hit.
I may have played that, to be honest.
Yeah, yeah. You can on the emulator, funny enough. Now,
very young
this is where the story gets a little bit weird, because what they decided to do with all these copies of E.T., the computer game, they put them into a landfill in New Mexico, which apparently is a landfill where Atari have dumped their stuff before. Perfectly legally, I hasten to add, not just digging holes and dropping stuff in them. This was an official landfill site.
They export it to Africa or China first.
Well, it's
the outsourcing the poisons.
Our old E.T. made his trip to New Mexico, and he's been buried in a landfill, and there was a mission set up a few weeks ago for a load of diggers to go over there and start sticking a shovel in the desert and try to find R.E.T., and it's just been reported that they have unearthed him in New Mexico. There's apparently thousands of titles there. It's all got rather interesting. What's made more interesting slightly is that the people that got the wrong end of the stick when this news first hit. Go and check it. Mashable have reported it properly. So you can see the whole article there, and I think they've got footage of them digging up the first copy of it. So a very interesting bit of retro computing there. Now, my question now is, after being buried for about 30-odd years in a desert in New Mexico, does the cartridge still work? So
they may have actually made those in the US back then, if it's like the 80s.
Yeah.
They may have actually had factories to make electronics. Imagine that.
No, well,
actually, they still have a few, actually.
Just goes to show you, they obviously make things to last in those days, because there's a very proud picture of a chap holding up a copy of E.T., surrounded by cameras, yep, and it says, yes, unearthed New Mexico, and gaming history has been discovered. So there you are, you can check that out over at Mashable.
Just north of New Mexico, they have lots of nuclear waste buried in mountains, which is probably safer than putting it somewhere next to the seashore, but it's becoming a real issue, and you know the U.S. Still manufacturing nuclear weapons and trying to modernize its arsenal, and the expense is something like tens of billions right now per year, and I think education and healthcare should come first, but I guess the Cold War is the next big war to make money to make some money from.
Yeah.
And there was some success, not so much in Syria. It did aggravate Russia, but nine Ukraine, they get lots of aggravation, and here we are, you know. Now there is justification for many countries to kind of beef up their military budget. So, that's another topic.
Talking of topics, I'm sure you have something else we can.
There is a bug in OpenSSL, and I wrote, I think, 4 articles about it, and if you would like to hear my opinion, I can share
it
briefly. So, nobody knew anything about a bug in OpenSSL. Although I had already covered one such bug last year when I wrote about Red Hat and connections it has to the NSA. Connections which, by the way, go beyond SC Linux, and staff from inside Red Hat confirmed that they even get patches sent from the NSA that they then submit to Linus, and he doesn't know it came from the NSA. So, and there is also a program which was explained by a FreeBSD developer from Denmark that would allow them to kind of put in bug doors, not back doors, but bug doors in software. So I already have a lot of suspicion, even of companies like Red Hat, when it comes to backdoors. I wrote several articles about it, and the company's staff, when replying to me, was not really able to counter what I had claimed. That was a real cause for concern. But we already know that there were attempts to put backdoors in Linux several times before. And even the father of Linus Torvalds, this is something we hadn't had time to cover, spoke about it. So here we have this situation with OpenSSL again. And I only knew about it because there was a website one morning, and the website was a .com website. It has a logo, it has a nice catchy name and stuff. And I decided to explore who is behind this thing, and it turns out it's a partner of Microsoft. And who's they? The chairman of the board, the former chief of security at Microsoft, who had also worked for the FBI. And you know, the FBI knows all the tricks of how to infiltrate software. We now know the NSA apparently knew this trick for at least 2 years since it happened. And this thing was announced on, I think, the 7th of April to the public, which is exactly, curiously enough, the same day when a lot of corporations, some of which I work with in the UK, basically said, okay, this is the last day that Windows XP is a supported operating system. It's not secure anymore. Let's move to Linux and open source. So I think there was a strategic disclosure there. Now, this firm did not actually discover the bug. The bug was discovered quietly in Google sometime before, but this company just abducted the bug, gave him a name, it did a whole kind of PR campaign to promote this thing, and completely flood the press with bad publicity for FOSS, like, is FOSS still something you can trust? Of course, because a few lines of code that completely changes everything you ever knew about open source, even though Coverity, which is tied to the US government, a few days later published a study saying, again, free software has got better quality than proprietary code in terms of bugs. So I wrote several posts highlighting, the most recent post is actually quotes from the company itself saying that it exploited the thing to publicize itself. And the day that they did that, it basically completely distracted the world from the idea that Windows XP, many users, especially in companies and governments, are still using it. It distracted from the idea that people should move to free software, and everything to do with free software at the time was just, is it secure enough? Is it not secure? You cannot trust it, and so on and so forth. So I think it was a big PR campaign. Is the bug so serious? Yes, it's quite serious. However, it's things like this kind of happened before, and it takes a lot of computing power to exploit those bugs. So those with supercomputers can probably exploit them, the NSA, for instance. But no apocalypse has happened since then, and the latest articles will just tell you this was just a big hype over something that was serious, but, you know, not that serious. And when it was announced, all the major GNU/Linux distributions had already patched the bug. So all they had to do, basically, just apply the patches, you'll be fine. So it seems to me like there was a big publicity stunt. And I don't even want to say the name of the bug, and it's all just marketing, and it's rather gross. It completely flooded the news over the past 3 weeks.
Well, I think there is a concern by everybody with an interest that when XP went the journey, there would be certainly looking at other options and solutions. Whether big industry would have ever considered going elsewhere for their, or big corporations.
These computers would not run any version of Windows except XP. Few of them would. Probably not Vista or Vista 7, but the only logical step now is just just move to a distribution of Linux.
There is some people cashing in on this on its redundancy, as it were, because I've seen a couple of companies that have been written about in some of the mainstream press that's offering support and security and etc. etc. For people that aren't wishing to move. I mean, certainly not an option for the home user who sat with XP stuffed up on their desktop machine. But for a corporation that's maybe got 100,000 deployments of it, it might be a cheaper alternative rather than a complete migration to anything.
Well, how long for?
I don't know. I don't know.
And also, these computers are fairly old. Remember, this is really getting long in the tooth. So if you pay people, I don't know, 20,000-30,000 a year, and a computer that's new would cost you less than £1,000 to buy, productivity would matter to you.
One thing I would say about any sort of migration to any different ecosystem or operating system is that people say about retraining, and I think that's over-exaggerated. When they say, people switching from, say, a Windows to a Linux system, they need retraining, and it's going to cost you more to retrain all your staff than it would be to upgrade to our latest.
They can still use the old applications and application servers, and this is what we do for one of the clients is, let's say you want to take them out of an XP environment. The major barrier usually is they have applications that weren't designed for other versions of Windows or something. So all you need to do is to make sure you have a server somewhere that's capable of running those things and people can remotely connect to it. They can use Linux. There's no issue with that. They can use remote desktop or VNC or something. And they can use it.
I think it's very different now because, for example, I've deployed a lot of Linux to users of Windows. I hasten to add these are home users and just average people who have a computer for average means around the houses, they're certainly not corporations. And I've deployed Linux to them. And over the years, what I've noticed now is the amount of, for want of a better word, training in order to show them the differences and say, look, this works slightly different to what you're used to. This is better because this does it this way. Is less because, and the reason why it doesn't need so much training is because we do so much of our everyday living in the browser. And of course Chromium on Linux is exactly the same as Chromium on any other operating system,
and the interface of the browser is usually within the page itself as
exactly
to the browser and is just back and forth,
and as long as they can read an icon that says Chromium or Firefox or whatever, it's really, there's no more training that's needed to be done than that. What I have noticed recently, actually, funnily enough, was a lot of people that I've given Linux to using DOSBox a lot, which is quite a nice little utility for them to have on the machine.
Some corporations use it as well.
Yeah.
They use things like FoxPro still, and in some cases even other operating systems, so they use some emulation or compatibility layers.
Well, it's mainly because the people that I've deployed Linux to are from the old school of text adventures and things like we were mentioning earlier, of King's Quest and Sierra Online games, and there's probably no better way to get the original experience than to run it in DOSBox. And it's a very modest little package because it's not one that you hear talked about all the time. You hear MAME, which is a multiple arcade machine emulator, and that's talked about quite often. It's a very big project on Linux.
Well, you have FreeDOS, so it shouldn't be so hard to write something that runs those applications.
But it's a very modest package because DOSBox works incredibly well. It is an incredibly efficient little utility. And it's like I say, you've got so many options now within the Linux operating system to get old functionality back on for old packages that use. I mean, I know many companies that use very, very old DOS programs, and they've got no reason to change because it works and it does exactly what their staff have been there for 10, 15, 20 years expect it to do, and there's no issues. And this is where, for the rest of the staff, where they're using most of the stuff in the browser, I mean, many many of the big organizations I've been exposed to use a lot of web-based applications themselves within an intranet, which they've developed themselves, and really all you require is a browser. And in fact, using Internet Explorer is probably the worst possible solution. And they openly embrace things like Chromium or Firefox or whatever. So yeah, it's the migration issues now, and the retraining issues are really a non-starter. And I would expect, especially with things like Crossover or I've had a mental blank now about the other, but Wine. You've got applications like that, and there's no reason why, certainly for a lot of new utilities that you may want to run, you may already find there's Wine compatibility. So there is no real training issues.
Wine has been incredibly useful, actually. When migrating company to any other operating system for that matter, it can be some form of Unix or BSD, but they want to be able to run the applications at least temporarily as a kind of a cushion, because Wine is doing a very good job running those applications. It doesn't encourage developers to develop it, you know, for a certain API the way Mono does. But given that they're stuck with a binary that only runs in Windows and was designed for Windows, it would be useful to have it running under.
It's also quite nice. I mean, there's certain little packages, proprietary packages that you stumble across on the net and you would like to have a look at them. And Wine excels. I mean, I've chucked quite a lot of stuff at Wine, which obviously isn't on the compatibility charts because it's really secure. What's the word I'm looking for? I've now lost the second word. It's really obscure. And I've chucked it at Wine. It's loaded fine. The nice thing about Wine is it's so transparent. Unless you actually know that you're using Wine and make a conscious decision to use it. I know if I put it onto one of the people's machines I installed Linux on, they wouldn't even know. They would assume it was just a Linux piece of software, because unless you look for the subtle differences and look at the windows, you really don't notice the difference. And I mean, I'm looking at my desktop now, and I'm running Peppermint 4 at the moment. I think we covered this very briefly last episode. And really, if people are loving XP and they don't want to leave that, there is very little difference in an XP desktop to Peppermint 4. I look at my start menu, and it's got a menu instead of a start word. It has a slightly different icon, which is a peppermint stick type thing rather than the Windows logo. But everything else is pretty much exactly the same. I've got a nice little landscape background. They have all my icons on the desktop and a few things in the start menu. But it's all looking pretty much like XP. And if you were to show somebody who didn't know computers or have an interest in them and say, do you like my XP desktop, you probably wouldn't even notice at all. And when you get into the realms of, you know, people using Chromium and people using Thunderbird for their email as well, because Outlook's horrible, really, there's no reason why they can't switch over with no training whatsoever. In fact, quite contrary, because a lot of people now using smartphones are very used to a software center. Well, what's Linux had for many years? They've had software managers and software centers where you install software like you do on a mobile phone, which is something that they're used to. Which is very different to the days of going onto Windows, downloading an .exe file, installation file, installing it, and then clicking the yes/no prompts. This does everything for you. There's even places where people can look at the package on their software center and see the reviews, so they can see other people's opinions on the software, and they know that they're not going to be downloading a virus, or actually guaranteed they won't be downloading a virus, because it's coming straight from the repo itself, not from some possibly dodgy website.
Has Microsoft ever gotten around to having something similar implemented either for Windows or for the mobile platform?
I don't know. I mean, when I say I haven't used Windows since 2008, I haven't. I mean, I've used it briefly, like when an employer might be using it, and I've had to get onto a machine, and I might have used a bit of Microsoft Office, but physically sitting down exploring Windows, I've never done since I was dual booting XP in 2008, and then Vista came along and decided I'd go 100% Linux.
So Apple's following the footsteps. So
I think Windows 8 has a software center of sorts. I'm sure it does.
Okay. So at least two people are happy now.
Yes, but I mean, yeah, it's funny that Linux has had this for so many years, and Linux has had the stereotype of being inaccessible to new users. Yet Linux has had the software manager, which is something that everybody's loving to use on their phones.
The name recognition of the, I mean, today I found an application, I couldn't even tell you the name, starts with K4, and it's basically an application which replicates an application for other platforms, including Windows, and it goes through your entire hard drives and maps all the files by size, and it allows you to find big files and directories. This is a very nice application, but I wouldn't know it by name unless I was searching using iXQuick and just searching for some of the graphical disk space utilities, and this was one of the first one they listed, because I was looking for a very specific type of thing. Now the issue is, when a person comes to GNU/Linux, he or she will not know what they're looking for. They will know things by brands. I'm looking for the, you know, the Blue E, or I'm looking for my Office, you know, my Office or my Outlook or something. That's the issue. And when you say to them a long word like Thunderbird, then what the hell is that? Thunderbird, it sounds immediate. It sounds like, you know, Thundercats or something. And their immediate reaction, just like, I don't know it, I don't want, you know, and that's really the biggest concern, I suppose.
But then, I mean, Thunderbird itself, you know, with I mean, a lot of people now using the web to using a browser, sorry, to access their email. I always gauge the sort of mainstream trends by my parents, because they're the last people to want to jump on board a software package and learn it. So what they're using tends to be, in my opinion, quite typical of the average user who has no interest in the computer that they've got, just using it as a tool. And my mother is using her email via the browser. So even she knows that Outlook isn't for her. And same with my father as well. They both have their own accounts on the same machine and just log in via the web page. Talking of which, just very briefly, I was saying about running Peppermint, I do need to quickly mention two things. Firstly, Peppermint 4. I covered this on my website, and anybody who's looking to move elsewhere, maybe they're disillusioned now with Windows and they like the XP environment or an XP type environment, please have a look at Peppermint 4. Fantastic distro. Very, very small, very tight and compact. It's got leaning towards a cloud, but in no way forces you to go that way, and you can quite easily install file software center, which works in the same way as your mobile phone software center, as many locally installed packages as you like. Very, very quick. In fact, I don't think you'll find a quicker distro as it stands, because your speed is really only limited by the amount of time it takes to load up a web browser and services you're accessing and your broadband speed.
But that would be to do the desktop environment. Linux is Linux.
It's so. I mean, it's a very punchy distribution. It doesn't load anything that you wouldn't need immediately. Everything is, if you want to install things, obviously that's up to you. But the package that you're presented with when you install it from the disk is very simple, and everything is ready to go onto the net, and it's got that in mind. Like I said, if you want to take that to a locally installed stage later, that's your choice. But
whatever happened with Mozilla had a kind of boot to Firefox thing.
Sorry?
And Mozilla had a kind of initiative, at least maybe 2 years ago, something about booting into Firefox. It's not Firefox OS, but there were several, I can think of even Presto from Zandros. So some companies were trying to market this idea of just basically booting a browser with an operating system as an open shell, something along the lines of what you've just described. But I don't think it ever really succeeded so much.
I mean,
Chrome OS is not quite that. It's something different.
No, there was Jolly Cloud. Remember that one? I believe that's still going. Jolly Cloud was virtually nothing more than a booting into a browser.
They renamed. They used to be called Jolly something else. What was the previous name?
At the time, that was very pioneering stuff, because at the time we didn't have the infrastructure available to the average user to make that worthwhile, in my opinion. Now we've got Google Drive, for example, offering you storage space at £1.49 for 100 gigabytes. You've got all these online services and apps. I said to you, I think a few weeks back, there's a web-based Amiga emulator now, which runs absolutely perfectly, which allows you to emulate the old Amiga range of computers without having to even install a single thing on your computer. We're at a very different level now in terms of the cloud and in terms of online applications than we were all those years ago. Things like Jolly Cloud were quite pioneering at the time, but really a bit before their time. Whereas now we are dedicated to being online. Most people, if you switch off their net connection, really would sit and look at their computer screen and say, right, I'm going to go out and do something else. Because so much of the stuff that we do on an average level is to do with the internet now, be it social networking or just playing computer games even now. Can I just make one other mention, which we failed to do, I believe, in the last episode, and that was the software we're using to record this. For people that have listened to the show, and my dulcet tones for far too many years, will remember we used to use Skype a long time ago. We didn't like using it, we had issues with it, but at the time it was one of the only ways we could connect up without many errors and get a reasonably sounding show together and get it out there. So the views on using Skype itself were put to one side. Luckily, when Microsoft took over Skype, we discovered Mumble at the same time, because we were looking for an alternative, and that's what we're using now. And Mumble, if you haven't used it, is absolutely fantastic package. It's not the same type of thing that you'd get from Skype. It's not built to have an address book and be a sort of a telephone system or VoIP system. It's meant for online gaming, and it's meant to get communities together talking to each other. But we're using it at the moment, and as you can hear, it's working very well. It's very simple to use, and thoroughly recommend it. I'm sure Roy will back me up on
it. Lots of features, and it's very simple to use. It also puts security as a kind of high priority, and you have to establish connection with SSL, so with certificates too. So it seems to be designed by integrating a whole bunch of open source packages. It's possible when you actually install it, you can see which ones they are. And this is a very good example of where, in my, I'm not sure on your side, but on my side, it also uses Qt4. So it uses a very nicely KDE type environment. With wizards and everything, it looks very native and it looks very nice. The one thing that should be mentioned though is this is marketed, strangely enough, as more of a gamer's environment for chats, and I think it's a bit of it's kind of a missed opportunity, because this is a really fantastic application that could be expanded to be more, more easily used as an alternative to all the SIP clients the team and I have been investigating over the years.
What I was going to say, what about Mumble? I don't know what version you're using, Roy, but mine's 1.2.3.49 as well. But that was the one that came out of my repo. But what I like about this is
using Qt on it, Qt.
Yes.
1.2.3. So
what I was going to say was what I particularly like about Mumble is it's very, very transparent in that at the moment Roy is recording this whole conversation. Obviously, this is part of the show which he'll put through a few audio processes before he'll put it out onto the net. But the nice thing is by his name, there's a little red dot which lets me know he's recording. And when he presses a recording button like I'm about to now, you'll hear it works. Hopefully that
I'm not sure it will be audio.
I was hoping that would come out over the thing, but basically it tells you very clearly.
Yeah, the voice synthesis basically inside the application.
It's a really nice package, and like Roy was saying, completely wasted in terms of the other applications it could be put to if it was not sold or marketed. That's not the right word, but introduced to other people, because I mean, it's virtually a VoIP IRC is how I look at it, because you have so many servers. There doesn't appear to be any sort of rules in terms of which servers you can connect to. If you can connect to them, I assume you can use them. Me and Roy are the only two people in this particular channel at the moment.
And the servers themselves are free software. The backend software is called Murmur, and I never really tried to run it, and I didn't set up an instance to host it. I think there is a commercial company coming out of this, you know, free software thing, commercial, what do you know? Because when I searched for information about it, I found a .com website, which basically provides hosting of, you know, servers for this facility. So maybe if you're in a company and you're looking for a web conferencing tool that would enable you to encrypt and to secure your communication with SSL, and you don't want to use something like Asterisk, this might be an opportunity. You can set this up, you can go into chats, you can communicate cross-platform.
I agree, and it's probably one of the travesties of the open source world, because, like I say, packages like this, you don't hear about. It's not on... not spoken about all the time, or I can't remember how we came across Mumble. I think it was purely a directed search for a replacement to Skype. But people should be talking about these packages, because, as I say, me and Roy, and obviously we have an agreement with our opinions are favoured towards free and open source software. But having said that, we don't give a package an easy ride, and if it causes problems, I'm sure Roy would be the first to say the problems as much as I would. But there's been no simpler package in terms of ease of use, setting it up, common sense UI with requesters that actually make sense and do as they say, than Mumble. It's been an absolute pleasure to install.
Since we mentioned that, okay, Mumble is mostly for multi-person communications. It doesn't have to be. It can be one like myself and team right now. And you can define rules by which some people will be listeners and some people will be active participants. So in theory, you could also do a live show. And this is something we're going to be working towards, I think, in the coming months or whatever. But here's the thing. I tried a lot of SIP clients on Android and GNU Linux. And the ones that worked best for me, and trust me, I did try quite a few, and the team would know that as well. On Android, use LeanPhone. LeanPhone works really well with any of the other clients that are using SIP. On a GNU / Linux desktop, use Jitsi. Jitsi. That's the only one that really works for me really well. Not necessarily always with video, but sometimes with video as well. And that uses Java. Fortunately, but it works well, and it shouldn't be hard. As I've spent, I would say almost 1,000 hours, maybe, using it basically as a phone application between an Android phone and a Linux desktop. So it's a very valuable combination. It's possible to completely avoid Skype. You just need to know which applications to use. That's all.
Well, we certainly haven't used Skype since we discovered Mumble. And when we came back to recording, it was a very simple process to get straight back into it. In fact, like, I think we had the whole system up and running within about 5 or 10 minutes. And that was both of us installing it and then getting hooked up together.
There are some applications people should be very careful when they install. One of them is Skype, especially the version from Microsoft, which had been modified over the past couple of years to change the architecture of the exchange and transmission of data, and that apparently enables much simpler surveillance, real-time surveillance as well. And we now know that the intelligence services also tap into videos in real time. And another package would be Dropbox. Dropbox would encourage people, whether it's on a phone or a desktop, to upload files immediately. And we spoke about it last show. I mean, even Condoleezza Rice is now giving her seal of approval to Dropbox in the form of her joining the board, basically. So it's kind of clear that the company doesn't have any interest in people's privacy. Rice is a very big proponent of surveillance and has been for at least 9 years. That's as long as I've known her, being a big proponent of it. And another thing I would warn people about is anything to do with Facebook, including the applications for Facebook, which, as I found out, shockingly enough, not myself personally, but it tends to transmit people's data automatically. They just say yes to some question, and every time a person takes a photograph, it will be transmitted to prison, to NSA. Google is becoming just about as bad, but the head of Google Plus has just quit Google. So hopefully people may by this stage realize a lot of the so-called Google Plus users are not really users, they're used, and they don't actually participate in any way in the network. It's just Google trying to auto-subscribe people and push them to clicking an OK button to add themselves as a so-called, you know, member of Google Plus, but it's mostly Google employees and some technical people, as far as I can tell.
Well, on that note, I think we'll wrap it up for this session. I know you certainly had a time limit, and I certainly have one as well. If I may, Roy, I've got one more little quick mention to make, and something quite amazing. And once you hear this, it's going to completely ruin your life, probably, if you're a Pac-Man fan. And since our show today has been quite directed towards gaming, it's quite relevant that we finish on this one. This was something I picked up on Twitter, and like I say, it's one of those things that once you've read it, you can't actually unread something. And said in such a way that when you read it, you have to follow the instructions because you're interested to hear if it's right. And this is what it is. It's a picture of Pac-Man, and he's got three of the ghosts on this poster. And it says in text, it says, "Did you know, if you put a finger in your ear and scratch, it sounds like Pac-Man." Well, I read that, well, that's ridiculous, I can't possibly do that. And anyway, so I put my finger in my ear and scratched. True enough, it does actually sound like Pac-Man, the noise he made when he was eating the berries or whatever he ate on the game. So there you are, you can find that on my Twitter timeline, that and a load of other useless facts. I apologise for ruining anybody's Pac-Man memories, if they have any. And Roy, I sincerely hope, Roy, when you stop recording, you take the headphones off, you put your finger in your ear and scratch, and you'll see what I mean. It does really sound like Pac-Man. So on that basis, I'm going to close the show off. We've got no objections from Roy. Hopefully we'll get another one done in the next few days. Although we always say that, then I end up letting Roy down, and Roy ends up having to wait until I turn up back up in the IRC channel and we get something organised. So let's hope for the next few days. Roy, it's been a pleasure as always. And I think I'll leave the final words with you, Roy.
If you had any. Well, basically, so you've returned from my creative absence nearly a year, in fact. We covered surveillance in a previous show. Today we mostly focused on games, which wasn't necessarily the intention. We didn't plan this. There's still plenty of things we can cover in the mobile space, desktop, servers, and so on, but the unfortunate thing is we sometimes have to decide whether to kind of focus on the latest news, as in today's news, or the past week's news, and even things like the past, you know, year's news. And I guess it depends very much on the importance and granularity of the matters. What I'm hoping is that we'll kind of catch up with things we haven't discussed before, because a lot has happened. You made a prediction about Balmer being given the boot, and you were right. It just took a bit longer than you thought.
Yeah.
And I was right in the sense that I kind of knew what they would look for in a candidate to replace him. And I don't have to say very much, but I think it was said very well in the joke a few days ago that in late 2016, that will be the day that every person who used to be a racist for disliking the president will become a chauvinist.
Right, well, that's... I was going to say if I could just justify my prediction for a second, yeah? I remember saying that Balmer was going to go in 2008. Was originally when I think I wrote it in an article, and I predicted that. So on the basis that it took about six or so years for that to come to fruition, it's probably safe to say that the prediction wasn't particularly good, because he had
to leave. You said it's also 2012.
So I'm
thinking about his prediction, actually.
I remember saying it in 2008 on the site. Well, it's a bit like predicting that one day Microsoft will cease to exist. Well, it will. It might take a while, or it might be quite quick, but it was quite an open prediction. So, to be fair, since Steve Ballmer left Microsoft, it's not...
It didn't leave Microsoft.
Well,
no, since, yeah. He's still in charge. Actually, yeah. The one in charge is Bill Gates, that's for another show anyway.
Yeah. It was a shame, and I miss the old fella, because it gave us something to laugh about when he was at the forefront of Microsoft PR and dancing on stage and stuff. So, yes, he's sorely missed, just not in the way he wanted. And on that note, Roy, I apologise now. I have to say something as well before we shut this show down. So if you're finished saying... your piece. I'll firstly say thank you very much for everybody who spent an hour and a half of their life listening to us both. Roy had some very important to say, me not so, but at least you've got to stick your finger in your ear and make noise like Pac-Man. Although what I do want to say is just take this opportunity to say well done to Luton Town. We've now been promoted into the Football League. I'm sorry, Roy, I know this is a technology thing, but I have to say it because I'm a big Luton Town supporter. And Andre Gray, our striker, has now been awarded the Golden Boot Award because he scored the most goals in the league. So, well done to Luton Town, and I'm going to hopefully be getting down there for the celebrations. And I'm really sorry I had to drag it into the bike show. So on that note, thank you for listening, and hopefully I'll still be here next time and Roy hasn't kicked me off the show. And... look after yourselves and speak to you soon.
It's Friday night and I'm gonna get sauce. I fought the troll and the troll lost. I fought the troll and the troll lost. He tried to boss me and was outbossed. I fought the troll and the troll lost. I fought the troll and the troll lost. Underneath his creeper bridge, hoping goats will cross. Quoting Ashcroft and Tom Ridge, I fought the troll and the troll lost. I fought the troll and the troll lost. He's even dumber than Mickey Koss. I fought the troll and the troll lost. I fought the troll and the troll lost. Wouldn't last 2 minutes with David Frost. I fought the troll and the troll lost. I fought the troll and the troll lost. His worldview sounds like pro wrestling, although not as nuanced. Behind his eyes the wind's whistling. I fought the troll and the troll lost. I fought the troll and the troll lost. I kicked him off a Pentagon and Atrios. I fought the troll and the troll lost. I fought the troll and the troll lost. He's permanently banned from daily costs. I fought the troll and the troll lost. I fought the troll and the troll lost. And in November, W and all his thugs will toss. We'll try to fix America. I fought the troll and the troll lost. I fought the troll and the troll lost.
And all you trolls out there trying to aggravate everyone with your stupidity, illogic, and blind, unthinking devotion to the Bush regime, this section is especially for you. I'm not going to name any of you out loud, not wanting to give you even the slightest possible notoriety, but as you sink under the weight of your own asininity into an intellectual La Brea tar pit, you can imagine that I sing your nom de guerre right now and bask in a stolen fame you don't deserve.